I'm turning now to the first book of Samuel, chapter 21 and verse 1. 1 Samuel, chapter 21, verse 1. Then came David to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David, and said unto him, Why art thou alone, and no man with thee? And our title is Faith Faltering and Revived. David is now on the run from Saul. He has been anointed king, semi-secretly, by Samuel. He's been some years at court, but now, because of the great jealousy of Saul, the king, he has become his enemy. And also because Jonathan, the king's son, has sided with David, though Jonathan is very doubtful about whether King Saul really aims to destroy David. But nevertheless, now is the beginning proper of David's having to flee from Saul. And this is his first act here, and we're going to see the gradual decline of David. He's behaved himself impeccably up till now. He's been in a very difficult position. He's exercised tremendous faith. He had that great victory over Goliath. He's been God's man in every sense. He's aware of his calling. He believes he will be king one day. And he's been set in charge of Saul's troops. He's gone in and out of court. He has done nothing to excite Saul's jealousy himself. But from his flawless behavior and faithful demeanor, we begin to see now some problems, even in the life of David. And they will recur as life goes on. And in that, there are great lessons for us. Well, he goes to Nob, where the tabernacle has been temporarily erected, and Ahimelech is described as the priest. Well, he's the acting high priest. And Ahimelech is afraid that David enters the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, alone. And there doesn't seem to be any immediate sign of troops with him. There is a party of troops with him. There's no question of that, but they're kept in the background at this stage. And Ahimelech is insecure, strangely insecure. He knows, obviously, that David now is being pursued by Saul. How does he know? Well, a man named Doeg is there. Doeg is described as a chief servant of Saul. He's a high official in charge of land and estates and herdmen. He's a significant person, and he's an Edomite, historic enemies of the people of God. And he turns out to be a treacherous man, and he's there. And David will realize that Ahimelech's life is in danger if he's seen to be showing favors to David. And Ahimelech is aware from Doeg that David has become the king's enemy. So Ahimelech is suspicious and insecure. Why art thou alone and no man with thee? And then in verse 2, there comes what is often called David's lie. And at this point, we're looking at the erosion of trust. Is it an out-and-out lie? David said unto Ahimelech, the priest, The king hath commanded me a business, and hath said unto me, Let no man know anything of the business whereabout I send thee, and what I have commanded thee. So he adopts this posture as one who is on a special mission that must be kept a great secret. Some people think that in panic he was driven to invent this story because of the presence of Doeg, about whom we shortly learn. Because he would know, David would know, that Doeg would go back to the king and say, Ahimelech has conspired with David. So it was possibly to cover Ahimelech that he told this story. Others say it's an outright lie. Still others say, if there is such a thing, it's a kind of partial lie, because it's in all probability David, as the chief military man for Saul, had a kind of permanent commission to cover him when he was carrying out secret missions or conveying secret counsel and advice. And he doesn't so much utter an outright lie, but he deploys this commission that he has conveniently to cover his visit to Ahimelech. So, if you don't mind the language, if there is such a thing, it's a kind of half lie or a quarter lie. And I'm inclined to think that that's more the case. David would have had a commission to command people to secrecy for his actions, and he may have felt that would cover Ahimelech. Whatever Ahimelech did, he was under the impression the king was on, David rather, was on a special mission for the king. But nevertheless, it isn't the whole truth. However you explain it, so this isn't the same David as we've read of in the previous chapters. David, whose trust in the protection of God when on a mission for God was so complete and so profound, but now he's having to construct a way out. And that's the first step of the decline of even the noble David's deep trust in the Lord. Well, he asks for bread for those who accompanied him out of sight at the present time. Verse 3, now therefore what is under thine hand, or in your custody if you like, what do you have? Give me 5 loaves of bread, or whatever there is. And the priest answered, there's no ordinary bread, but hallowed bread. And the Lord Jesus Christ quotes this incident in justifying his good works on the Sabbath day, but we won't go into that now. David was right in this, that he could use such bread, and so was the acting priest. But I want to say something about Ahimelech. Ahimelech should not have been acting as high priest. This was really quite out of order. Yes, he was a legitimate priest in one sense. He was a descendant of Aaron. He was the grandson of Eli. But that's the point. You go back to the beginning of 1 Samuel to chapter 2, and you read about Eli and his sin in that he did not reprove his sons who were acting as priests, and they were behaving scandalously at the tabernacle of the Lord and cheating the people and encouraging them to cheat. They were deep sinners, and Eli, as an old man, had not reproved them, and he was bringing contempt and evil upon Israel. And the prophet was sent to Eli, warning him that his line would be broken, that his sons would perish, that all their descendants would perish, that his priesthood would come to an end, and none of them would live to be old men. Well, Ahimelech is under that judgment. He is a descendant, well, a grandson of Eli, and he should have stood down. He shouldn't have been functioning. But here you've got a case of a family that went on just as though nothing had happened. They took no notice of the message from God, of the prophecy that had been given. They were clinging to office and to their functions, and they were under the judgment of God. So, and it happens in these very chapters. But for the moment, down here, David answered the priest, gave him assurance about the good conduct of the men that were with him, who could be given the showbread. Verse 6, so the priest gave him hallowed bread. Now verse 7, you read about Doeg. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. Detained before the Lord really indicates to us that he was a proselyte. Though he was an Edomite, he'd become a Jew. He was a proselyte, second grade, as it were, Jew, and he served Saul. So he was presumably there to pay some vow, to offer some sacrifice. His name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chiefest of the herdmen, which is no inconsiderable station, in charge of all the herdmen, the staff, the farming staff on Saul's estates. And that's as much as we read about him for the moment. Verse 8, then David said unto Ahimelech, and is there not here under thine hand spear or sword in your possession, in your custody? For I have neither brought my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. And the priest announces in verse 9 that there, wrapped up behind the ephod, is the sword of Goliath, kept there in the tabernacle of the Lord, the house of God, as a trophy, whom thou slewest in the valley of Elah. Behold, it is here, wrapped in a cloth, behind the ephod. David said, there is none like that, give it me. Now, David is on a downward slide here. He's already constructed a fabrication of a kind, whether very serious or partial, to save his situation. And now he's not jolted back to his usual faith, even by the sight of Goliath's sword. This should have reminded him of what up to that point had been the greatest moment of his life, when God empowered him to deal with the Philistine champion, and he felled him, and he was filled with faith and trust, and he stood to represent the Lord, and not only before the Philistines, but before the children of Israel. There was a message in it all. Trust in him, look to him. Now he sees that sword of the man he slew, and it still doesn't move him. Back to trust, convict him of his wandering. Verse 10, and David arose and fled that day. And that brings us to another heading. We're seeing the erosion of trust in David's lie. And now from verse 10, we see the complete collapse of trust. This is astonishing. David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath, to Achish of all people. He reasoned in his mind, I've got to find safety from Saul. You can see here the complete collapse of trust. I shall find it in the land of the Philistines. Achish was one of the lords of the Philistines, king of Gath, a not inconsiderable part of the Philistine host. He went to Achish, the king of Gath, the very place that Goliath hailed from, their champion, their great hero. There, he thought, I will be safe. There, Saul will not pursue me. Well, now he's become almost, you might say, irrational. This is crazy reasoning. He certainly would be safe from Saul, but he wouldn't be safe from the Philistines, from Achish, king of Gath, of the Philistines. Why is he doing this? Why is his faith running down to the point of collapse? Well, one can only make suggestions. With Saul turning against him, He has lost his station. He's lost his security. He's lost his comforts. He's lost his authority. He's lost his following for the time being. He's lost a great deal. And the result is the effect upon him is an erosion of faith. And we note that we can have losses. You can lose various things in life. You can lose people who are dear to you. You can lose in your career, in your work, in your business. Everybody's lost something over the pandemic and lockdown. Perhaps you've lost your normal rhythm of life and been on furlough and everything is different. Perhaps you've been turned into a home educator from whatever you were, line manager of a not inconsiderable number of people. Who knows? There have been great changes. Be careful. Be careful that it doesn't erode your faith, that the loss of the pattern to which you're accustomed and the provisions and the comforts and the rewards, if you have them, to which you're accustomed, doesn't erode your faith. Perhaps that's what it was that shook up David, so that the impeccable David suddenly becomes rocked with fear and insecurity and seeking his own way out of problems by his ingenuity. But it leads to a collapse of trust. He goes to a Philistine. Has he not been the conqueror of Philistines? Did he not lead the rout of the Philistines? And how is he going to maintain the support and the favor of the Israelites if he goes over to the Philistines? How can he ever be king if he's seen to be on their side? It doesn't make any sense. But it's the same with us. We can fall rapidly an awful long way by skipping devotions, allowing our solid trust to be eroded away. It can have results we never expected and a loss of faith on a large scale. You feel down? Turn to the world for entertainment? Go back to the old debased music? Go back to things like that? There are consequences. Faith is being eroded and it might collapse altogether. Well, verse 11, the servants of Achish, the courtiers said unto him, "Is not this David?" They describe him as the king of the land. From a Philistine perspective, to have seen David in charge of Israelite troops and so successful, they've completely discounted the ineffective Saul, and they see David as king already, which of course he isn't. Is not this David the king of the land, effectively? Did they not sing one to another of him in dances? David has slain his 10,000. And David was crushed by all this. He laid up these words in his heart and was sore afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. And you read in verse 13, the famous incident, he feigns madness. He lets his saliva drool down his beard. He suffers in this great act personal humiliation and a loss of honor and dignity. How far down he's come in that he has to resort to this to get out of his situation. But the saving grace is this. He did also pray. It doesn't say so here, but in the midst of this feigning of madness and this pathetic groveling behavior, he falls to prayer, and he tells us so in the Psalms. With the result, verse 14, that Achish turned the blame on his servants and said, "Why have you brought this madman to me? Get rid of him." And it was David's opportunity to escape and we'll come back to that in just a moment. But let's turn for a few seconds to Psalm 34. And in Psalm 34, the inscription over the psalm puts us in the picture. A psalm of David, when he changed his behavior before Ahimelech. Our inscription here says Abimelech, but it's Ahimelech, who drove him away and he departed. Psalm 34 is about just that. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make her boast in the Lord. The humble shall hear thereof and be glad. Look at verse 4. It tells us that alongside his own acts to get his deliverance, he sought the Lord, and he heard me and delivered me from all my fears. They looked unto him and were lightened, and their faces were not ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. Now he's back to faith. The angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him and delivereth them. He's so filled with praise and gratitude. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that trusteth in him. Well, he hadn't, but then he had by the end of the story, and God had forgiven him and blessed him. And so the psalm goes on, verse 11, come ye children, hearken unto me, I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Well, certainly he will. David has slipped and fallen and brought himself into terrible circumstances. But then he's called upon the Lord, and the Lord has delivered him. He seems to be saying to us, I had to learn the hard way, so that you don't have to learn the hard way. Never let your faith in the Lord slip. Maintain holiness, verse 12. Watch your tongue, verse 13. It was his tongue that let him down in the first place. Depart from evil and do good. Don't have to fear the outcome. Verse 15, the eyes of the Lord are always upon you. They're upon the righteous, and his ears are open unto their cry. The face of the Lord is against them that do evil, to cut off the remembrance of them from the earth. And then the promise of answers to prayer in verse 17. The need for contrition and repentance for sin, verse 18. The Lord is nigh unto them that are of a broken heart. His heart was broken by the situation that he'd brought himself into. He had a contrite spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth him out of them all. We could go on to Psalm 56, which also is about the same period, the same time, the lessons that David learned. Psalm 56, you look at the inscription, when the Philistines took him in Gath, be merciful unto me, O God. You see, we read here that he prayed. Be merciful unto me, O God, for man would swallow me up. He fighting daily oppresseth me. The case is building up against David. They no longer trust him. Mine enemies would daily swallow me up, for they be many that fight against me. O thou most high, what time I am afraid, I will trust in thee. A climax of fear drove him to prayer. In God I will praise his word. In God I have put my trust. I will not fear what flesh can do unto me. Every day they wrest my words. All their thoughts are against me for evil. They gather themselves together. They hide themselves. They mark my steps. They were watching him all the time. Well, then, verse 11, In God have I put my trust. I will not be afraid what man can do unto me. Thy vows are upon me, O God, which means God has laid vows upon David, and now he makes them. But they're the vows that God has given them him. He must keep them in the future. For thou hast delivered my soul from death. Wilt not thou deliver my feet from falling, that I may walk before God in the land of the living? Beautiful words, both of those psalms, in connection with the deliverance from Achish, the king of Gath. And I go back to 1 Samuel, and now chapter 22, and the scene changes, and it brings us to another heading, David restored. David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave Adullam, or as we would say, the cave of Adullam, some 10 miles southeast of Gath, and about a dozen miles from Bethlehem, where his father's house was. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down hither to him. His parents were now aged, but they and all the family, I don't know about the brothers, but all the extended family and the servants, the whole household, they went to David. You might think they fled to David because they now knew if David was on the run, their lives were in jeopardy. But their lives were even more in jeopardy with David. He was the main target of the wrath of Saul. So I'm inclined to think they're standing with him. Maybe the brothers too now stand with David, and they make their way to the cave Adullam. And David arranged for his aging parents to go to Mizpe of Moab. Well, he had connections there with Mizpe and Moab. Ruth, the Moabitess, was David's great-grandmother. So there was obviously safe accommodation there. And he said unto the king of Moab, at that time anyway, let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me. And he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while that David was in the hold in the cave Adullam. And the prophet Gad, chapter 22, verse 5, said unto David, abide not in the hold here, depart and get thee into the land of Judah. Then David departed and came into the forest of Hereth. So now God is speaking to David through Gad the prophet, a faithful prophet, one from Samuel's school of the prophets, and communications, as it were, from God, direction of God, is fully restored to David. Here is the restoration of David. And in verse 6, when Saul heard that David was discovered, he was at large, and the men that were with him, now Saul abode in Gibeah under a tree in Ramah, having his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. Well, I missed something. We'll come to that. I want to tell you about verse 2. Because in addition to the household of David, he had quite a few other people went to the cave of Adullam. Everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented. The Hebrew word is bitter in soul. What's this? Were there people who were in distress because for some reason or the other, Saul's kingdom, the state, has oppressed them? Everyone that was in debt, probably because of hostile action, from Saul's administration, and everyone that was disenchanted with the kingdom under Saul. They gathered themselves unto David. Well, he may not have chosen such people. It may not have been David's first choice, but God so moves that all people in need, suffering from adverse circumstances, who were able-bodied, or 400 of them anyway, flocked to him and became his private army. And this has been described many, many times as a type of the church. And so it is. That's all we are, dear friends. We're people who found ourselves in distress because of our sin and because of our condemnation before God, and in debt, with a great debt of sin to pay, and discontented and disenchanted with this rebellious world and our own lives. And we gather ourselves to Christ, and he's our captain. But we're a despised band and a persecuted band in many ways. Yes, it is. It's a type of the church. Well, we come down to very quickly to the end, the last verses of chapter 22. Doeg, the Edomite, reports to Saul, who's become utterly paranoid and believes that everyone is plotting against him and nobody is giving him the credit he deserves. And Doeg, the Edomite, strikes in the middle of Saul's discontent and says to him, yes, and there's your high priest, Ahimelech. Effectively, he says, conspiring with David. Ahimelech makes a little speech when he's sent for. It's very well handled. It's a defense of himself, but it's no good. And Saul orders his execution and the execution of all those who are with him, the priests and those that live in Nob, the priestly city. So it's as if God takes his hand of protection away from the priesthood and its subjects to the fury and sinful, murderous act of Saul. But they shouldn't have been functioning. And you may think of things today. God says, don't do this, don't do that. And sometimes even ministers, they do it anyway. God gives instructions for the conduct of his church. Don't mess with the world. Don't compromise. Don't use their entertainment and pollute your worship. And people do it anyway. And God may still use them for a time. And like Ahimelech, they're left in office. They're left functioning. Even David trusts them. But God has said there'll be a reckoning. And they can't be greatly blessed. And one day all that house will come tumbling down. I don't say if they're true believers that they'll lose their salvation or they'll be horribly dealt with, but there will be a price to pay. And in the day of reckoning, they'll be like the person referred to in 1 Corinthians, who in the day of judgment finds his work has all been burned up, though he himself is saved. Same with, if I may give an example, women preachers. Some of them may actually, who knows, not a field I'm conversant with, they may be preaching the truth. And there may be a benefit to some people. But like Ahimelech, he shouldn't have been functioning. He'd been disqualified. He was a descendant of Eli, but he took no notice. And he carried right on. And people today, you say, look, the Bible says you shouldn't do this. They carry straight on. They may be believers. God may even use them to a degree. But ultimately, that work has to be lost. And you see that here with the loss of Ahimelech and his household. But I want to close just on a slightly different note, coming down to chapter 23. Then they told David, saying, "Behold, the Philistines fight against Keilah, and they rob the threshing floors." Well, why hadn't Saul dealt with it? He had crack troops. He had the army now. Why hadn't he sent a detachment to deal with that Philistine incursion and to deliver the people of Keilah, who now were in danger of starvation because their crops had been destroyed, their threshing floors had been destroyed? Now, what you have at the end here is a token of David's calling. He's slipped, he's fallen, he's been restored, and he and Israel are given a token now of what will be in the future, that David will be their defender and their champion. Therefore David inquired of the Lord, verse 2, "Shall I go and smite these Philistines?" And the Lord said unto David, "Go and smite the Philistines." How did he inquire of the Lord? Well, we read in a few verses that the son of the high priest had escaped the slaughter of Doeg and taken with him the ephod. So David was able to consult the Lord. Verse 3, "And David's men said unto him, Behold, we're afraid while we're here in Judah, in a forest. How much more then if we come to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines? Aren't you going to consider us? We're terrified where we are. And there we'll be outnumbered vastly by a Philistine army." And David considers them. And it is as though he says to them, "I will consult the Lord again." Listen, I think he does it for their reassurance. He's now a leader and protector of others. Then David inquired of the Lord yet again, and the Lord answered him and said, "Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will deliver the Philistines into thine hand." So they went and they fought and they won, and they brought away the cattle and smote them with a great slaughter, and now there would be no more starvation in Keilah. And then you read in verse 6 of how Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, had taken an ephod with him when he fled to David. And he told David about the death of the priests, and David was mortified. He thought he'd caused it. He hadn't, of course. It wasn't his fault. And they had been under, anyway, the ultimate judgment of God. But here, David is given a grand token of what will be the future for him and the success that would be his as a protector of Israel, a token of his calling. So we've been looking at the erosion of David's trust, possibly because of his change of circumstances, not making excuses. That led in turn to the complete collapse of his trust. Then he prayed and called upon the Lord, and he was restored. And now God restores his directions to him and gives him a great token for the future, a tremendous success. You cannot overstate this, 400 men against the Philistine host. So there's a compact lesson and warning and yet encouragement for us. We don't have to always learn the hard way, as David, even Grand David, did on this occasion. Never let us let our trust slip, not for a moment. Dear friends, our closing hymn will be 458, My gracious Lord, I own thy right to every service I can pay.